Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. At a contentious meeting, Box Elder County okays a massive data center project backed by a celebrity investor. As mass deportations mount, Latino Latter-day Saints ask, where is the church? And amid a measles outbreak, Utah's vaccine skepticism has spread and looks impossible to change. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley and data columnist Andy Larson. And right now we bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sam Moylanen. Sam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Happy to be here.
So you've been right in the middle of this Box Elder hyper data center debate. I think you attended the previous meeting and then this latest meeting where the County Commission approved the project. I guess, first of all, I'm just curious to set the scene, maybe before the meeting began and then as the meeting began.
Yeah, so the meeting was at 4 o'clock on Monday, but ahead of the meeting around 3, we saw people started coming in. At first there was about like 30 people and then it quickly grew to more than 300. People were there for a rally. They had signs that were, protesting the data center for a number of reasons. The biggest one I would say being the water concerns with the Great Salt Lake. And there was Ogden Indivisible, who was organizers with that group that were speaking and kind of doing this like rally format outside of the county fairgrounds where they were going to have the meeting. And then about 15 minutes before 4 o'clock, I would say, people started coming in and the entire room was full. We definitely had over 1,000 people that packed into that meeting.
So the meeting begins, protesters kind of in the back, right? A lot of interruptions.
Yeah. So, the meeting started, at 4, and one of the commissioners said that there wasn't going to be public comment. And that kind of set this negative tone right from the start, because people were already really upset that there wasn't a much opportunity for public comment before this decision was on the table. That kind of created this chorus of boos from the crowd. There was a lot of jeering. And the commissioners kept trying to tell everyone to be quiet and that if they, kept interrupting, they would be removed by the officers that were there. But the thing was, it was kind of like the entire crowd. I mean, it wasn't just, one or two people that you could take out of the room. It was everyone. Eventually the commissioners were trying to kind of do this presentation and provide some information about the project, but they couldn't really get through a sentence, without people interjecting. I just think people were very upset about not being able to voice their concerns. And so they were just, kind of shouting out questions or comments.
What was the tenor? What kinds of things were they shouting out? What did they have on their signs?
Yeah, a lot of the signs were just about, the Great Salt Lake and air quality. People are very concerned about, what's going to happen to the valley and the area surrounding it. A number of reasons, but I think the biggest one is about saving the Great Salt Lake. I mean, people are just across the state. People showed up from, we had Salt Lake County, Utah County, but then obviously you had Weber County, Cache County, Davis and Box Elder. And everyone was kind of this unified opposition because they're so worried about our water. Signs said save our water or you can't drink data. This isn't the place. Don't sell us out. This one woman, she said she made over 200 of these little yellow signs that just said in big letters, no data center. And she passed those out. She said she ran out within 15 minutes. And another woman, she was from from Logan, and she said she was worried that like her children are going to have to move away from Salt Lake City because if the Great Salt Lake dries up, then as we all know, it's going to kind of create this like toxic dust bowl. Those are definitely the biggest concerns. And then the wildlife too. There are a lot of people that are worried about, you know, how that's going to affect like the birds and, you know, the wildlife that we see in that area. It's just a very, like the Hansel Valley has been used for agriculture for as long as, you know, people in the area can remember. So it's kind of this like, you know, beautiful untouched valley that's used for ranching, and very few people actually live in the valley. But once this, you know, if this data center goes in, it's going to obviously completely change it.
Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary, the main, I guess, celebrity developer here, he accused, I guess, protesters of being bussed in from out of state. Did you see any evidence of that?
No, I did not. You know, we saw were school buses that drove by occasionally because there's a school nearby, but we didn't see anything like that. And, you know, the organizers actually had, you know, a moment during the rally where they were like, you know, shout if you're from Box Elder, if you're from Cache, and kind of went through like down the list of counties in the area. And there was definitely, you know, a lot of people from around the northern counties. And then we saw some Salt Lake and Utah County as well. I mean, we didn't see anyone that was from out of state, but definitely, you know, from people that were across Utah.
I'll turn to the county commissioners. Of course, they're the ones charged with approving or not approving this. One of the commissioners said, according to your reporting, that they were looking at this as kind of narrowly. They were not touching on water air quality. That was other approvers to talk about that, I guess.
Yeah. That was Commissioner Lee Perry. And yeah, he said that their vote had nothing to do with water air quality because those aren't issues that the county has any control over, essentially because the water rights tied to the project are held by private landowners. So the commissioners basically said that this is a, you know, private landowner issue where, you know, the landowner rights, you know, they can do with their property what they wish. And the commissioners kind of said they don't feel that they can, you know, make that decision for the landowners. But on the other hand, people are like, you know, some people that are in opposition are like, well, it has everything to do with water or air quality because, you know, their vote essentially allowed MIDA to create their project area. And MIDA has said that they need full support, approval from the landowners and the commissioners to move forward. So without the project area, you don't have the project. So it really was a very big decision that was placed on these three commissioners. But at the end of the day, they said the land is unzoned. It's unincorporated land. And it's all the private landowners that, you know, came and consented to it. So they felt like there wasn't much they could do there except just get the best deal that they could for the county by, you know, negotiating with MIDA and the developers.
They said they had read all of the public comments, more than 2,000 worth. I guess that probably didn't appease the crowd there.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to, you know, not this past Monday, but the week before, commissioners were actually set to decide on the project, and they had a special meeting at 10 a.m., and about 80 people showed up protesting. It was a very last minute effort. It wasn't, you know, as organized as we saw on Monday, because a lot of people had just found out about the project. They didn't even know about it until, you know, our story came out, and then other news outlets as well had stories after the MIDA board meeting on that Friday. So people came out and protested, and the commissioners had, you know, there was representatives from MIDA at the meeting, and you know, they did actually, you know, they were answering questions. You know, people in the crowd had signs, and they were kind of pointing to them, like, ask my question. And the commissioners did. And some people were interjecting as well. But it was like over an hour long meeting of just, you know, basically the commissioners asking questions to MIDA. And then at the end of it, they were like, okay, we need more time to decide. We need another week before we make a decision. And then that's when they opened up this like kind of form on the county website, and they were taking questions from people. So they had over 2,500 comments come in, and they said that they considered all of those when they were making their decision.
So there were the protesters, right, and they were interjecting. What was the actual meat of the meeting? What were were the commissioners interviewing anybody or having testimony from people?
For this past meeting?
For the latest meeting, yeah, on Monday.
Yeah, well, they did have a representative from O'Leary Digital. They had Paul Morris from MIDA. And then they had the county attorney, and I think a few other people that were supposed to talk, but they ended up, they started, you know, trying to share. This was, I mean, at the start of the meeting, I think they only got like 20 minutes in, and they were trying to share, you know, some updates about, you know, the water. And at this point, at the point where the like county attorney was kind of talking about all of the stuff that they tried to secure, like the deal with MIDA and how they tried to, you know, make it the best possible for Box Elder County, and how the county was going to see $30 million after the first phase, and then at full build out, they were going to see $108 million. I think people started kind of getting more upset at this point, and they, you know, one person was like shouted out like people over profits, as they were kind of, you know, presenting this anticipated tax revenue. And, you know, this kind of created this, like, the whole crowd kind of joined in, and they were like, okay, like, you know, chanting people over profits. And then we had one of the commissioners, he said, for hell's sakes, grow up. This is beyond a joke. And that really, really incited people. You know, and then at that point, the commissioners decided to leave the room. And they put up a big screen, and they just started a Google Meet and immediately approved the project.
Did they make any comments after, or did specifically why they approved, and anything in favor?
Well, they had a press conference after, but there was no other. They didn't address the crowd after that. They just had like a few comments, I believe. But at the press conference, that was when they kind of, you know, went through their statements and, you know, said all of the factors that they considered, but how they felt like the economic benefits, and given that the property owners had agreed to it, that they felt like, you know, they did the best that they could for the county with the information that they had, the timeline they were given, and considering all of, you know, the other factors like the landowner consent.
I want to move to another story you have. Here's the headline: Silenced Voices, Double Standards. Box Elder County locals react to the data center approved for their backyard. You talked to some locals. Tell me about some of their comments.
Yeah, the next day we went around Trey Mountain and Snowville, which is pretty close to Hansel Valley, where the first phase of the project will be. And kind of the center of it, because that's where the Ruby pipeline runs through. And people seem to be very concerned about the what they felt was a lack of public input. The only opportunity for public comment was a few weeks ago, and it was just a regular meeting that had the Stratos project on the agenda. And the only people that showed up for public comment were the landowners, because they were the only ones that actually knew about the project. So people were very upset in that regard, because it was like, you know, the following week after that first meeting that no one even knew they could speak at anyways, the commissioners were supposed to decide on this. And so that was a big point of contention. People were also very upset with how the meeting went. They felt like it could have been handled differently. You know, this was something that a lot of people cared about, and they just felt like they, you know, it was kind of a deal that was done behind closed doors, in some people's opinions. Other people, you know, are very concerned about how it's going to change the area and the county. It's a very rural area, and like, especially Snowville, you know, everyone, we talked to one woman that grew up there, and she owns a restaurant there, that her family had owned before. So kind of like, she's been there her whole life, and she was like, it's just going to change everything. And with the 2,000 jobs that it's expected to create at full build out, you know, the people I talked to were very skeptical. They didn't actually think those jobs would happen. They said they've seen this before where, you know, a developer comes in, there's, you know, a project, they say it's going to create X amount of jobs. And then when it finally comes down to it, they get all of their tax incentives and the project, and the county doesn't even see as many jobs as were initially promised. So I just think there's a lot of doubt that this is actually going to be, you know, what MIDA and the developers are saying it's going to be. And just like this fear that it's going to really impact the area and the wildlife, like that, you know, some scientists that another Tribune reporter I spoke to have said that this could create this like massive heat dome over the valley, which is very close to the northern point of the Great Salt Lake. So they're saying that like all of the birds and all the wildlife, it's going to kind of create this like dead zone, essentially, which remains to be seen. But, you know, it's kind of all up in the air. And that's what people were saying, is they're like, honestly, I don't know what's going to happen or what this is going to look like until, you know, it starts being built out, because there wasn't, you know, they didn't have to do any environmental impact studies before the decision was made. They still have to go through and get the proper permits and stuff now. But, you know, before the vote, it was like, they, you know, they really just felt like they didn't know what the impact is going to be. So that's kind of causing a lot of fear in people, because this is their home. It's been their home forever. And, you know, they live in rural areas because they don't want like a neighbor every few feet. They don't want a Salt Lake City. Like, they want to be out, you know, in the rural areas and in nature and have the quiet. So I think there's just a lot of fear of like what this could mean long term.
Just about a minute left in the segment. Any positive comments about the data center? Anybody looking forward to it coming in?
Yeah, I did. There was a few people that were excited about it because of the like economic benefits it could bring. Like, say the jobs do happen at full build out. You know, one woman was telling me she thinks that's a very good thing. It's a positive thing for the county. It's going to bring, you know, bring more businesses in potentially if there's more people, and that means more housing that gets filled up. And she was excited. She thinks that the county could use some of the economic benefits this project could bring. But I think that was the biggest thing. It was like, you know, this could be really good, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure you'll be covering it as we go along. Thanks for all this coverage now telling us about it. We've been talking on Behind the Headlines with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sam Moylan. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up following a break, we're going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Here's the headline: as mass deportations mount, Latino Latter-day Saints ask, where is the church? Later in the program, we'll be talking with data columnist Andy Larson. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. In this segment, we turn to Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Tamara, thank you so much.
Yeah, happy to do it.
Here's the headline. As mass deportations mount, Latino Latter-day Saints asked, where is the church? So, of course, we all know the Trump administration, big push, mass deportations. And so you talked to some Latino and Latina members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Give me a flavor of what they're saying.
So the common thread that I heard was that while this Latino and Latina Latter-day Saints living in the United States are by no means a monolith, right? Like that was stressed several times that you have MAGA members within these communities, that the majority and even I think overwhelming majority would like to see more from church leadership addressing this topic, especially as the mass deportations have separated families, an issue that has been one that the church has, in so much as they have set a red line, that is one they have set, is that whatever we do regarding immigration, it must keep families together. We know now that that has not been a priority for the Trump administration. And so I think there are a lot based on my conversations, and I should also note conversations had by Suhey Vega. She is a researcher out of Arizona. She is the author of Mormon Barrio, Latino Belonging in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which she did close to 50 interviews for in about a 10 plus year span. And so based on conversations she has had and that I have had with various members of this community in Utah, in Arizona, and in some cases I even talked to Latino members of the church who live outside of the United States who are watching this from across the different borders, there's a sense of trying to rectify the church's emphasis on families and families belonging together and what is actually occurring. And I heard some stories of people who had watched members of their own congregation, Latter-day Saint congregations, families in their own pews who had been separated because of ongoing current policies coming out of D.C.
Well, you kind of go back in the story of a kind of a history of what the church has said. 2011, church had a big statement where they decried mass deportation. Of course, kind of a constant throughout many of these statements is keeping families together. What else has? Then you go to 2018, the President Russell M. Nelson first in. He mentioned that as well.
Yeah, and in 2018, he mentioned Dreamers. So the kind of the points that the church has reiterated again and again since 2011, really, that was the year that they issued kind of this manifesto. And it's to date the longest statement that I've been able to find from the church on this issue. And it states that it iterates a couple of points that they've repeatedly come back to in subsequent years, and that is the importance of keeping families together, treating people humanely, and following the law. And I think that that's often read as okay, then illegal immigration, you know, looking at placing the burden of following the law on the immigrant. However, we know that there's been a lot of concern and alarm raised by judges and by legal scholars about purportedly unconstitutional actions and acts by ICE. And so the question is, does that keeping the law, does that apply to everyone here? And I think that many Latino and Latina Latter-day Saints would say, well, it should. And then at one point, like I said, in 2011, the church was quite, in this statement that it issued at that time, it specifically named mass expulsion, as it called it, as worrisome. But it has not in the any of the language that's used since the election of Trump and his inauguration, that has not appeared.
Oh, yeah, 2019 or so, the church re-endorsed the Utah Compact. Of course, that's several years ago now, right, which talks about keeping families together, humane treatment of immigrants, focusing on deportation of serious criminals. So, yeah, tell me what the latest statement said.
Yeah, the latest statements have, touched on those, said to follow the law, keep families together, treat people humanely. And the question is, what about, is the church willing to criticize the law? What about unjust laws? That was something else that I heard from sources that I spoke with.
So, Latinos, Latinas, what would the members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, what would they like the church to say?
Yeah, I think it varies somewhat person to person, but for some, it meant being openly critical of these policies and these approaches that ICE has taken that have resulted in family separation. And then there's also been a hope. There was hope expressed to me from a number of members who wish that the church would do more to help those who are impacted. Yes, there are some legal clinics that exist, some immigration welcome centers and hotbeds of immigration, and that is good, but more needs to be done. These are families that in some cases can't leave their homes out of fear, are struggling to find work, and that more assistance is needed to help keep these members of the church, help care for them.
Some are saying that they see a negative in the churches, what they see is muted response, and that they're still subject to sometimes hate speech, still subject to fear.
Yeah, and to call that out, right? Mm. Yeah, that was one of the harder conversations I had as part of this, was speaking to a mother in Provo who just like wept. I talked to her in three different conversations over three different months, and it was just like, every single time it was so emotional for her as she laid out the fear that her family felt, as she herself is Mexican, half Mexican, and her kids, she felt just so much fear for their safety, for her safety. And she understands that, like, or she, this, and she's talking about here, like, fellow Latter-day Saints, right? She's afraid of fellow Latter-day Saints who, and others, but that includes these fellow members who she really think could be reached if the leadership were to take a stronger stance in criticizing dehumanizing language of immigrants.
Some Latino Latter-day Saints are noticing that Pope Leo is speaking out. They're, by comparison, they're wishing their church leaders would speak out.
Yeah, there was this, that same individual drew a contrast between Pope Leo's condemnation of the Trump administration's immigration policies, which he has called inhumane, and the statements in the sermons that were given at a general conference, which occurred not too long ago, the LDS General Conference. And she said she just kept waiting for someone to touch on this, especially because it impacts so many members, at least in the United States, and just felt really saddened that, and felt a bit forgotten, I think, by the fact that the conversation, there didn't seem to be any real concern or mention of it.
Some are remembering Proposition 8 and how church leaders were quite prominent speaking out on that one.
Yeah, that was something that Suhe Vega really picked up in her research, where she talked to members of the church during an SB 1070, which was the Show Me Your Papers law that came out more than a decade ago now out of Arizona, and was sponsored by Russell Pierce, who was a Latter-day Saint. And it came on a couple years, I think, 2 years after, around the same time as Proposition 8, right? And Proposition 8 was in California. It had to do with legalizing the fight over whether to legalize same-sex marriage. And the church was very vocal and very involved in that. And saying, you know, this is about protecting families. And then 2 years later, you had SB 1070, which was threatening the families in Arizona, immigrant families in Arizona, led to, again, some separations. And so the fact that those two events happened so close together, and the church was so vocal in one and so quiet in the other, was a point of resentment and hurt from many of those that Suhe interviewed, especially those living in Arizona.
So some of these folks, they're talking about what they hope church leaders would say. Also actions. What actions do they wish the church would take?
Yeah, there was a wish that they would allow members to who do not have permanent legal status to work at church-owned food pantries, which is currently not permitted because of fears about the legality around that. That there was also kind of this nostalgia for the kind of front-facingness of the Gordon B. Hinckley days, where President Gordon B. Hinckley, a former prophet of the LDS Church, was very savvy when it came to media and being in front of media. And they wished that the current president, President Oaks, would be willing to take a similar sort of foray into the mainstream American media landscape. And in doing so, really use his platform to, again, call out the dehumanization of immigrants by members of the Trump administration and supporters.
So Suhe Vega, interesting, she had a comment on tension of two principles that the church leaders are stressing, family unity or obedience to the law. And when those are in conflict, she muses on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was one person I spoke to that thought that, or I guess actually I'm confusing now. So it was one of Suhe Vega's interviewees said that Heavenly Father prioritizes family unity over arbitrary borders or unjust laws. And the way I close the story is that then and now these members hope to see their church follow suit.
Hmm. Well, yeah, thank you for telling us about this interesting story. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your time.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Coming up following a break, here is the headline. Amid a measles outbreak, Utah's vaccine skepticism has spread and looks impossible to change. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson. Hope you stay tuned following the break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we turn next to your column out recently. By the way, in my promotional announcements, I've toned down the headline a little bit. Here's how I rendered it. Amid a measles outbreak, Utah's vaccine skepticism has spread and looks impossible to change. Either you or your headline writer put it this way: Utah's vaccine foolishness has spread and looks impossible to fix. And that gets into, I think, the consternation that probably a majority of Utahns feel about this.
Yeah, you know, and foolishness was a word we batted back and forth for what we're talking about. I think skepticism is, you know, is we're talking about how skepticism probably should be, or at least is, interpreted by a majority of Utahns. And it is, you know, something that I think impacts all of us when people decide to get these vaccine exemptions. And so, like we ended up going with foolishness because that's how I feel. You know, it is a data column, which does add a bit of opinion about how I interpret the data. And when I see kind of what I saw in interpreting these measles cases and vaccination exemption counts, I think it was the right word to use.
Now, you quote a New York Times headline, Utah becomes the new center of U.S. measles cases. Other headlines like this, Utah is the epicenter right now, I think.
Yeah, and 600, over 600 cases now that have been confirmed. And with that come a significant number of kind of unconfirmed or untested measles cases as well, given the high contagiousness of measles, right? And, you know, in a unvaccinated population, the average is that one person with measles would then pass that on to an estimated 12 to 18 people, which is significantly higher than, for example, a COVID or a flu. The COVID contagion coefficient was essentially, on average, about two or three people that you would transfer a COVID positive case to. So this is a really contagious disease, and that's kind of why you see health department officials reacting the way they are and encouraging the level of vaccination. But it does require 90 to 95% of people to be vaccinated in order to get herd immunity.
Very contagious. That's compared to COVID, that's interesting. Airborne, right? You get
yes, correct.
Catch it through the air. So you have some charts here. We'll urge people to go to sltrib.com, pull up your column here. You even have a interactive visual here. So first of all, tell us where the measles cases are concentrated.
Yeah, so in kind of more rural areas in Utah, and especially the Southwest Utah Health District, which is largely Washington County, but also includes Beaver, Garfield, Iron, and Kane counties. And then what they call the Tri-County Health Department area, which is kind of over on the eastern Utah side by Vernal. That's Daggett, Duchesne, and Uinta counties. That's where cases are at their highest. And it's a pretty high incidence rate where in that Tri-County area, for example, it's 121 cases per 100,000 residents. In the Southwest Utah Health District, it's 90 cases per 100,000 residents. Compare that to, say, Salt Lake County, for example, that's only 5 cases per 100,000 residents right now.
So then you have another chart, kindergartners missing measles vaccination by Utah Health District. What do we see there?
Yeah, and it's correlated, right? Where people are not getting vaccinated, we see higher case counts. Again, in that Southwest Utah Health District, 26% of kindergartners in the most recent school year were missing measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination documentation. The majority of those students have gotten vaccination exemptions through the state that allows them to skip those vaccinations for either religious or even non-religious reasons. That you can kind of fill out the form, watch this about 15-minute video and online education series, and then say, no, I don't want my kids to be vaccinated. About a quarter of parents in Southwest Utah have taken that option. In that Tri-County area, it's about 16%. And then just, again, comparing it to Salt Lake County for a kind of a local reference here, that's about 7% in Utah, in Salt Lake County, so significantly lower.
Then you have a slider, interactive. You can slide across, and what the slider shows is very strong correlation.
Yeah, I like to include these interactive graphics to give people kind of the ability to compare those maps by themselves. And obviously, we could just put them side by side, but it's fun to see if you kind of see them one image at a time sliding back and forth. There's a huge correlation where kindergartners aren't getting vaccinated and where these measles cases are spreading. And obviously that makes sense.
So 90% of people with confirmed measles cases in Utah were not vaccinated. You have another chart here, vaccination exemption rate in Utah health districts. Tell me about this one.
We've seen significant increases in how many kindergartners are getting these vaccine exemptions, or I guess I should say kindergartners' parents, right? But if you look only just 5 years ago, before the pandemic in the 2020 school year, for example, You get, Southwest Utah, remember, had a 25% exemption rate. It was only 8% then. The state of Utah is overall right now 12.7% of parents are getting vaccine exemptions. Now, in 2020, it was only 5.1. So we're seeing, a double or even sometimes a tripling of the number of students who are getting these vaccine exemptions. And, we talked about earlier, measles being as contagious as it is, you need 90 to 95% of the population to be vaccinated in order to get this herd immunity happening. And Utah is currently outside of that window. And that's why we're seeing measles cases explode. And where those, the New York Times headlines and everything else, the national headlines kind of call Utah the epicenter of where this is happening is because, in part because of these vaccine, well, I think in large part because of these increased vaccination exemptions getting us below that herd immunity threshold.
So 90 to 95% of the population to be immune, that herd immunity, you ask, is this achievable? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. One of the things I really wanted to understand in writing this article is there something we can do about it? Is there something, some sort of health department intervention? Is there some education plan that we can kind of encourage these parents to go through and just kind of understand, what the benefits are of vaccinating your children with MMR or any other vaccine? And, looking at research, and there's been a lot of research done on this topic, and what we find is that parents who have already, gotten a negative impression on vaccines, it's difficult to change their mind. That kind of these public service announcements or even motivational interviewing, some of these various intervention plans don't seem to have a impact or a significant impact on whether or not these parents choose to have their kids vaccinated. And in fact, in some cases can have a negative reaction, that if you actually, give them education and it may actually entrench their views and make it less likely they get vaccinated. So it's tricky when you're dealing with a populace that doesn't trust government messaging, how you can get these people to be more vaccinated. And I think, when our reporters talked to the Southwest Utah Health Department public information officer, for example, they kind of have felt that strain too. And as much as they would like to get kind of the information out there so that maybe people who haven't made a decision can be well informed, they're not having any success in changing the minds of those who have made a decision and choosing not to get their kids vaccinated. And they kind of feel, hey, this is a tough situation, and they just feel like they're in between a rock and a hard place.
You bring up in your column here a popular idea that's been tried various places around the country is motivational interviewing. So what is that?
Yeah, it's a kind of a, I don't know if psychological technique is the right word, but it's a kind of a technique that has been used to and had a lot of success in research in terms of changing people's minds about an ongoing behavior that they're doing. So frequently used in like addiction counseling, for example, where someone may be addicted to drugs or overeating or whatever it may be. And you kind of use these motivational interviewing techniques to talk to the person and understand what is behind the kind of negative behavior. And using that, kind of steer it in a better direction rather than just kind of a confrontation kind of method of intervention, right? So this is very listening based and very like, okay, I understand where you're coming from, but I'd like to kind of steer your behavior in this direction because of these reasons. And it's a very kind of logical process. So for example, in the Tri-County area, they actually tried to get people to do this, right? And trained health professionals and government officials over there on how to do this. And, unfortunately, we're still seeing increased vaccine exemptions out there. So, I think it was a good idea. And then there was a lot of kind of excitement in using these techniques in terms of trying to get more people vaccinated. But it turns out to not have a very big effect on how many people are vaccinated. It's about a 7% increase, so not a 7 percentage point increase, but just a tiny increase in terms of how many people actually do get vaccinated who go through the motivational interviewing process.
You mentioned that during this year's last legislative session, Representative Trevor Lee ran a bill, did not pass, came close to passing, which would have eliminated the need to watch that 15-minute video for a parent to get an exemption.
Yeah, and that was, you know, it was in the health committee up at the legislature. So we're not sure how it would have fared kind of over the overall legislative body. But in that committee, it deadlocked at a 6-6 vote. With a couple of senators, representatives missing that vote. So I'm not sure how that would have gone had the full committee been there, but it was an event. There was a lot of public comment from, you know, both the doctors and physician side of things, as well as the Utah Eagle Forum sent representatives in favor of Trevor Lee's bill. But yes, so there is currently a online education module that parents have to complete before they can get these vaccine exemptions, and Trevor Lee proposed eliminating that module before getting one, and because it was a deadlocking committee, the bill died there.
You mentioned there is a provision in Utah law which might encourage some parents to not get an exemption or to vaccinate.
One of the interesting things is, current Utah law says if you have a vaccine exemption, if you don't have your child vaccinated, they may be asked to stay home for 21 days or more if there is a measles exposure event. So essentially, if there is a measles case at your child's school, those who have been vaccinated can continue to go to school and learn and continue, you know, be a healthy kid. But those who have not been vaccinated may be asked to stay home in order to prevent the spread, right? And so I think this is kind of an interesting idea that we are seeing measles cases in these schools and in kind of the public sphere. And so if kids are being sent home and all of a sudden these parents now have to either take care of their kids or find other child care options, maybe that is the thing that will make them kind of rethink the vaccination exemption decision. Now, I'm not sure if that will happen. And frankly, I'm not sure even how often this happens in practice, but it is in the law that says these kids can be sent home and maybe even should be sent home in the case of a measles case in their school, a measles exposure event. Then, you know, these parents have to make a decision whether they want their child to be vaccinated and return to school, or they have to stay home for 3 weeks or more.
Now, you end your column on a not so optimistic note, a quote from the public information officer of Southwest Utah Public Health Department. Share that with us.
Yeah, he said, once everyone's immunized that is going to be immunized, it may just need to run its course over the season or maybe even a couple of years. And, you know, it's, I feel for David Heaton and the team on the health department down there, and you know, they're obviously trying to do their best in getting people vaccinated and keeping their community healthy. But like I said earlier, they've run into significant issues with how the vaccine is being viewed in their community. And if a quarter of parents are denying their children the vaccine, it becomes impossible to keep measles from spreading because it is so contagious, especially in the winter months when everyone is inside. So yeah, it becomes really difficult, and I kind of understand the frustration here, and then that is kind of the end game, right? Is if you can't get people vaccinated, and remember, measles was eradicated in the United States just 10, you know, just as of 2000, extremely recently. But if you don't have the herd immunity necessary, then the other way people get immunity is by spreading measles, which is unfortunately can be a serious disease, especially in young infants and children.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson. Andy, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks again, Tom.
You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Very special edition of the program next week. I'll be in St. George. I'll have with me Southern Utah reporters for the Salt Lake Tribune, and we'll be concentrating on Southern Utah with the program live from St. George. Hope you join me next time.